Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you from the Rocky Mountain town of Crested Butte, Colorado. I'm your host, Mark Troutman, CFP. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. Welcome to episode number 6 of the Mark's Money Mind show. Here we are at the beginning of April 2024. I thought it would be a good idea to walk through a tax return. As most of you are aware, tax returns are due on April 15th. So many of you probably have already filed your tax return for 2023. And if not, you're probably very busy working on it. You can, of course, file an extension. However, that does not extend the requirement to pay any taxes that are due. So I thought we would walk through a tax return, and the best way to do this would be to get a copy of your tax return, and we can walk through this together. I'll give you a moment to do that. Okay, of course, you probably paused it to get your tax return, and now we're back. So let's take a look at the 2023 Form 1040 U.S. Individual Tax Return. And at the top, you will have your name, your address, your Social Security number. I would always make sure you double check to make sure your Social Security number is accurate and that the address that you have on your tax return is your current address. You may have moved, so make sure that it is filled out correctly. The next section of the tax return is the filing status, and there are a number of boxes that can be checked. There is single, there is married filing jointly, there's head of household, there's married filing separately, and there's qualifying surviving spouse. This is based on your status as of 12/31/2023. And the best way to figure out your appropriate filing status, most people know if they're single or if they're married. The one that does get a little confusing is head of household. And then for some people, whether they are eligible for qualifying surviving spouse. So I like to think of it from a kind of a yes and no answer to walk you through what your filing status should be. First question. Were you married on the last day of the year? And if the answer is yes, and your spouse did not live apart from you in the last 6 months of the year, then you are married filing jointly. Very simple. If you were not married as of the last day of the year, the next question is, did you have a spouse die during the year? And if the answer is yes, you will still be able to file married filing jointly. If the answer is no, the next question is, did you pay more than half of the cost of keeping up a home lived in for more than 6 months by the taxpayer's qualifying child, parent, or other living relative? If the answer is no, then you would be filing as a single individual. If the answer is yes, you may qualify for head of household. Somebody that is divorced or a single parent and they have a child that lives with them and they pay more than half of their upkeep. That's the primary reason somebody would qualify for head of household. And then the question is, well, what benefit does that give you? The brackets for single or half of that for married filing joint. Head of household, the brackets are a little wider than they are for single, not quite the same as married filing jointly, but you get a slightly higher standard deduction and your tax brackets are a little wider. So if you do qualify, it's advantageous to mark your filing status as head of household. Qualifying surviving spouse, as I mentioned, if your spouse died in the current tax year, you would be able to file married filing jointly. And for two additional years beyond that, if you have a dependent child, you may be able to file qualifying surviving spouse, which effectively is the same tax brackets and standard deduction as married filing jointly. So that's the filing status. Now, the next section of the 1040, there's a question that needs to be answered regarding digital assets. And that's basically virtual currency. And as of right now, the IRS is asking a question. This happened to be added to the tax return a handful of years ago. They are trying to find out whether people have had digital asset activity, and if so, they may be required to report income or potentially capital gains on these. So the question is, did you receive, and that would be like a reward, an award, or a payment for services, any digital assets, or did you sell, exchange, or otherwise dispose of a digital asset? In other words, there was a sale. And if there's a sale, there's a potential gain that needs to be reported. You must answer this accurately. They may use this in the future to go back and potentially audit people. If you've answered yes and they do not see any capital gains or any income reported as a result of digital assets, you must answer this question and you should answer it appropriately. The next section is standard deduction. In here, it's just asking you a few questions. One is, can someone else claim you as a dependent? So you might mark that box if you are a dependent of a parent, let's say, and you want to file a tax return to get your federal income tax withholding back. If, for instance, you are underneath the standard deduction amount or you have a reason to have a refund, you would still file a tax return. But since you're a dependent of someone else, you need to mark that box that you are dependent. The other boxes apply to people that are over age 65 or blind. And this applies to both you and, if you're married, your spouse. And that will enable you to have a slightly higher standard deduction as a result. The next section is for dependents. So if you have a child, for example, that is a dependent of you, their name would go in here, their social security number, their relationship to you. And then typically the tax software is going to automatically check after you've answered certain questions if they are eligible for the child tax credit or the credit for other dependents. Child tax credit is for dependents that are 16 or under, and the credit for other dependents would be a dependent that is over the age of 16, but still a dependent, and that can be up to age 24 if they are a full-time student, so a college student, for example. Then the next section of the return is where we get into the meat of it and all the numbers. So line 1A, if you notice, the next section is all about income. Line 1A is where you would see your W-2 income from box 1 of your W-2. All of your W-2s combined will be added and put in 1A. There are some other income items, lines 1A through 1I. Usually, most of these don't apply to many people. Usually, it's just 1A that you will see filled out. However, some of these lines may apply to you, but it's less likely. And then line 1Z is adding up all of those lines. Then the next section, lines 2A, 3A, and 2B, and 3B, are interest and dividends. And they are typically ported over from Schedule B. So you could look further in your tax package to see Schedule B, where all the detail of this will show up. But here are the total numbers. Tax-exempt interest goes into 2A. Taxable interest, which is what most people would have if it's a savings account or investment account that has a money market fund or mutual funds that have taxable interest, you will see in line 2B. In line 3, B is where you will see ordinary dividends, and the portion of those ordinary dividends that are considered qualified dividends that get a preferential tax treatment will show up in line 3A. And again, you can look at Schedule B for the detail that is brought over into the main 1040 here on lines 2 and 3. In lines 4, 5, and 6, this is where you're going to see retirement account distributions or pensions and annuities. And pensions would include things like a 401k, for example, and Social Security benefits. So this is an area to really pay attention to, lines 4A and 4B, because these are IRA distributions typically going to be reported on your 1099-R. And even if you did, let's say, a rollover, you left work and you rolled over your 401k to an IRA, the amount of the rollover is going to show up in line 4A. However, if it's a non-taxable rollover, which most rollovers are, that taxable amount in 4B may be zero. And you may also see the word rollover printed next to line 4B taxable amount. This is also where you would see, let's say you took a distribution from your IRA, you're over age 70 and a half, and you had that amount directly sent to a qualified charitable organization, you can do what's called a qualified charitable distribution, or QCD, and that amount that went to the charity is not taxable. Now, you need to make sure that you appropriately identify this in your tax software or tell your tax preparer so that amount is not taxed, because it's not evident by looking at the 1099-R that you did a qualified charitable distribution. And to know whether it was picked up appropriately by the tax software, QCD will be printed right next to line 4B next to the word taxable amount. If you were doing a backdoor Roth IRA, you want to make sure your distributions and taxable amount are shown correctly on the return. You may have done a contribution to a traditional IRA, but you did it without taking the deduction and then immediately converted it. That is a backdoor Roth. You would want to make sure that you would see the total distribution on line 4A, but the taxable amount may only be a very small amount as a result of any change in value between the time you made the contribution and time you made the conversion. So that's an area, 4A and 4B are definitely areas to really look at carefully to make sure the numbers are being reported correctly. The next one is pension and annuities. If you have a pension from work, even if you have a 401k, if you have an annuity, the total amount distributed will be in 5A. The taxable portion will be in 5B. Social Security benefits, they show up in line 6A, and the taxable amount will be in 6B. For many people, as much as 85% of their Social Security is taxed. You will see a lower number in 6B, the taxable amount, than you will see in 6A, but it might not be materially lower. And then we get down to line 7. That's where you're going to see your capital gains and losses, and look back further in your tax package and look for Schedule D, and that's where you will see any activity from short-term and long-term capital gains, and that number will show up here in aggregate on line 7. Now, line 8, this is additional income from Schedule 1, line 10. There are a handful of schedules. There are three schedules, Schedule 1, Schedule 2, Schedule 3, where additional information is calculated and reported and then brought back onto the 1040. I'm going to jump over to Schedule 1 and look at line 10. And here, typically what you're going to see, there's a number of line items in Part 1, and line 10 is the total additional income reported from Part 1 of Schedule 1. The typical items you may see here are business income, if you owned your own business and you report your business income on Schedule C. And again, you can look back in your tax package, you will see a Schedule C that reports all of your business income if you have any. And then you may potentially have rental real estate, and that would show up on Schedule E, and that number is going to be brought on to line 5. And then if for some reason you were unemployed during the year and you received unemployment compensation, you would see that reported on line 7. Those are typically the numbers that most people may see from Schedule 1 getting totaled up on line 10 and then brought back to line 8 on the 1040. Line 9 is simply totaling all of the numbers above up. And then we get to line 10. We go back to Schedule 1 again. And this is the information from Schedule 1, line 26 this time. So let's look at line 26 from Schedule 1. And these are adjustments to income. Typically, they are going to be deductions from income. And in most cases, what you may see from here, there are a number of items that are in Part 2, adjustments to income from Schedule 1. But the most common that you may see are if you made a contribution to a health savings account, that's tax deductible. So you'll see that. You may see if you owned your own business, the deductible part of self-employment tax. You may also see if you had health insurance you bought on the marketplace and you're self-employed, you may be able to deduct your health insurance premiums. You may see that. If you made a deductible IRA contribution, you may see that. You may also see any student loan interest that you paid and is deductible on there. So those are just some of the common items you'll see as adjustments to income from Schedule 1, Part 2, and the total is in line 26, and that is brought back onto the 1040 in line 10. And then we move to line 11, which is the adjusted gross income number, or AGI. This is a very important number. It is used for calculating other kinds of credits. Frequently, you'll hear something called MAGI or MAGI, which is modified adjusted gross income. That number actually does not show up anywhere on your return, but adjusted gross income is modified in some cases, sometimes with tax-exempt interest, the number in line 2A added back. In many cases, modified adjusted income may just be the same as your adjusted gross income. And that is reported on line 11. And then we start to get to subtracting the standard deduction or itemized deductions. A majority of people will claim the standard deduction. And the standard deduction for a single individual is $13,850. And for married filing jointly, it's $27,700. For a head of household, as I said, higher than single, but lower than married filing jointly, it's $20,800. You have a choice of using the standard deduction or itemizing your deductions. And itemizing your deductions comes from Schedule A. Most tax software is going to calculate your itemized deductions and look to see if they are larger than the standard deduction and use the larger of the two numbers. In approximately 90% of tax returns, the standard deduction is the one that is used because it is larger. To give you an idea of what is included as an itemized deduction, it would be medical and dental expenses. However, only those that exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. And that's a fairly high hurdle. So most people do not qualify for deducting medical and dental expenses because it will require a fairly substantial amount of expenses. The next section is taxes you paid. That would be state and local income taxes, state and local real estate taxes, or any property taxes, but limited to $10,000. So even if you had $15,000 of state and local taxes, the maximum you can deduct is $10,000. And then the next section of itemized deductions are interest that you have paid. And in most cases, this would be people's mortgage interest. So that is added in there as well. The last common one is gifts to charity. So any charitable contributions you made to a qualified charity would be included here. Many people think that gifts to charity will be deductible on their tax return. That is true, but only if you itemize. So that is why many people are not able to deduct charitable gifts, because the standard deduction may exceed all of these itemizable deductions and therefore will not be included on the tax return. Okay, so now we subtract the standard deduction or the itemized deductions from adjusted gross income, and also some additional deductions may be qualified business income deduction if you own your own business. In some cases, you may see this on your 1099 that you receive from an investment company. Some funds may have a very small qualified business income deduction, so don't be surprised if you see a small number here that may just be flowing in from your investment account. And then the bottom of the first page is taxable income, line 15. Whew! Now we're through page one of the tax return. Let's move on to page number two. All right, flipping it over or looking at the next page or scrolling down, however you're looking at your tax return, we get to the top of page two of the 1040. And in this section, you will see tax and credits. Line 16 is the calculated tax based on your line 15 taxable income. And the way that works is we have a graduated tax system. There is a 10% bracket. There is a 12% bracket. There's a 22% bracket. There's a 24% bracket. And basically, your first dollars are taxed at 10%, then the next dollars at 12%, and so on. And the software will calculate this tax for you. There are some preferential tax treatments to things like qualified dividends and long-term capital gains. You may even pay 0% for qualified dividends and long-term capital gains, provided that your income is low enough. Then we have to jump back to schedules again. Look at line 17, the amount from schedule to line 3. So let's go to schedule 2 and see what schedule 2, line 3 consists of. Schedule 2, line 3. This is where it picks up any additional tax that you may have from the alternative minimum tax, AMT, which most people do not have that. It was very common before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but now it is not very common. However, what you may see here is what is excess advanced premium tax credit repayment. That's a mouthful. What this is if you receive healthcare on the exchange, you may be able to get a subsidy for the premiums you pay for health insurance. And the way those subsidies are calculated is it's based on your estimated income for the year, but it's trued up on Form 8962 at the end of every year based on what your actual income was. If you received an advanced premium tax credit that exceeded what you should have received based on your income, you may have to pay back some of that subsidy. And you will see that number here on line 2 of schedule 2. And then line 3 is basically adding that amount to any alternative minimum tax you may have. So that then carries back to the 1040, line 17. Then line 18 is simply adding the lines above. And then you may see on line 19, your child tax credit or credit for other dependents, if you have dependents that are eligible for those credits. And then we jump back once again to schedule three, line eight. Let's look at schedule three, line eight. It's a lot of back and forth here. All right. Schedule three consists of part one, which is non-refundable credits. So line eight is the total of non-refundable credits. And this could be things like credit for child and dependent care expenses. So if you had, let's say, daycare and you were eligible for a credit for some of your daycare expenses. If you had education credits, these are typically like the lifetime learning credit or the American Opportunity Tax Credit. Or many people may be eligible for if they've bought a new electric vehicle. You will see the qualified electric vehicle credit on this section of Schedule 3, Part 1. So those are some of the things that you may see that are coming back to you as credits on your tax return. So Schedule 3, Line 8, the total there is carried back to the second page of the 1040 on line 20. And then there's some addition and subtraction, and we get to another schedule, Schedule 2, line 21, going back to the schedules again. Now, if we go to Schedule 2, it's on the second page. Line 21 is the total of all other taxes. These are less common, but if you have any of those, they are going to be totaled up there and carried back to the 1040 on line 23. And this could be self-employment tax. So if you own your own business, you have to pay self-employment tax, and that's where this number comes from. Line 24 is your total tax. So we had the tax from line 16, and we had some adjustments, and that brings us to the total tax on line 24. Now, the next section is where we start to get to subtract numbers from what our total tax is. But line 24, I believe, is a very important number. A lot of people feel that they look at their tax return and they just want to know, am I getting a refund or do I owe money? And they think, if I get a refund, that's great. And if I owe money, that's bad. The reality is, what you want to be focusing on is what is your total tax liability, which is line 24. And there are some reductions from that. There are some credits that still can apply, but this is effectively your total tax that you're paying. And you can look at that relative to your taxable income and relative to your adjusted gross income to get an idea of what percentage of your income, whether it's total income or adjusted gross income or taxable income, is being paid in taxes. Now, when we get to payments, this is where you're going to see your withholdings show up. So withholdings are reported on lines 25A and B. Withholdings from your W-2 will show up on line 25A. Any withholdings from your 1099 will show up on line 25B. Now, what's interesting about withholding is that the IRS views withholding as being paid equally throughout the year, regardless of when it was actually withheld. So you could have withholdings in December from, let's say, a IRA, and that would be reported on Form 1099, or you may have asked your employer to withhold extra dollars at the end of the year if you feel like you're not going to have withheld enough throughout the year. And the IRS will view that as if it was withheld or received equally throughout the year. And when we get to estimated payments, you'll understand why that's important. So you will see all of your withholdings added up on line 25D. And that is subtracted from your total tax. So that satisfies part of your total tax liability. Line 26 is where you will see any estimated tax payments you've made or any amount that if you had a refund in the prior year, you could apply to the current year. And these totals are here on line 26 Estimated tax payments are made quarterly throughout the year, April 15th, June 15th, September 15th, and January 15th of the following year is when estimated tax payments are due. If you owe money, you are supposed to be paying your taxes throughout the year in equal amounts, and that's what estimated payments are. So if you had to make estimated payments, they should be made equally in those four quarters, and that's where that number will show up. Then there are some refundable tax credits that can be applied to your taxes here, and that would include the American Opportunity Tax Credit. It will also include some other credits that are brought over from Schedule 3, line 15, and they show up in line 31. So let's talk about what some of those might be. Schedule 3, line 15, is the total of Part 2, which is on the second page of Schedule 3. And you might see a net premium tax credit here. So that would be the amount if you were to receive a subsidy for healthcare premiums through the marketplace, and you should have received more subsidy than you did. That would be the amount here, which is the net premium tax credit. Or if you paid an amount when you filed an extension, that would also be included here. So that is Schedule 3, Part 2, line 15, and that gets carried back to line 31 on the second page of the 1040. And then line 32 is basically adding up all of the other payments and refundable credits, and then adding that to lines 26 and 25 to get the total payments. And then simply you compare your total tax obligation from line 24 and your total payments from line 33. And if you had more payments than your tax, you overpaid, which will show up in line 34 and you're due a refund. Or if your total payments were less than your total tax, then you have an amount that you owe, which is line 37. If you get a refund, like I said, you will see the amount of the refund in line 34. Most people will elect to have that refund automatically deposited into their checking or savings account, and you should see your routing number and account number and make sure that is correct so that the money gets deposited appropriately. And you can choose to apply some or all of your refund to the following year's tax obligation, your choice. And basically, it will be viewed as part of any estimated tax payment for that first quarter, which is due on April 15th. If you owe money, you will see that show up in line 37. You may also see a number in line 38, which says estimated tax penalty. What that means, it really means the penalty for underpaying your estimated taxes. It's not that you're estimating your tax penalty. It's actually the penalty on underpayment of estimated taxes. And again, the way this is calculated is that the IRS views that you should be paying your taxes equally throughout the year. Again, withholding counts as if it's all equal throughout the year, but estimated taxes, you would need to be paying them in equal installments in those four quarters that I mentioned previously. And if you don't, you may be subject to a tax penalty. There is a way to avoid that, however. There is something called safe harbor. And you can avoid paying an estimated tax penalty if any of the following apply. If you paid 90% of the tax liability that was owed on the return. So if you paid 90% of line 24 total tax throughout the year, through withholding and equal installments of estimated taxes, you will not have a penalty. That's option one. Option number two is if you paid 100% of the tax from your prior year that you owed. So if you look on your tax return from 2022 and your taxes owed were, let's say, hypothetically $20,000, and you paid at least 100% of that, then you would not have a penalty for the following year, even if you owed $100,000. As long as you paid 100% of the prior year's tax, you will not have a penalty. However, it's 110% if your adjusted gross income for that prior year was over $150,000, and that applies to whether you're single or married filing jointly. So pay 100% of the prior year's tax liability and you're good to go, or 110% of the prior year's tax liability if your adjusted gross income was over $150,000, whether you were single or married filing jointly. So that's a way to avoid the estimated tax penalty. And then at the bottom of the tax return, you'll see a sign here section where you will sign your return, or if it's done electronically, you may see a PIN number there that you've selected or the software has selected, the date of the return, your occupation, and if you have an IRS identity protection PIN, you will see that filled out. And then if you're married, your spouse will have a signature or a signature PIN number, date, occupation, and also the identity protection PIN if they have one. And if you had a paid preparer, you will see their information at the bottom of the return. And that is a tax return. I highly recommend you walk through your tax return, get to understand it, look at the schedules 1, 2, and 3, your itemized deductions. If you had itemized deductions, you can look at any other schedules you may have. Schedule C, which is profit and loss from a business. Schedule E, which is typically for rental real estate. You might have a Schedule D, which is capital gains and losses, and some additional schedules. It's definitely worthwhile looking through all the schedules that are behind your tax return to understand them. Other ones might include, if you have a health savings account, Form 8889. If you buy your health insurance on the exchange, you'll have 8962, which is the premium tax credit. Usually, tax software will also have a comparison summary that may not be included in your federal tax filing forms, but it may be included in additional information that you can see. It's always very interesting to look at your year-over-year comparison to see what your income is, what your deductions are. It will typically show you what your marginal tax rate is, which is your last tax bracket or highest tax bracket. And it will also usually show you your effective tax rate, which is your taxes relative to your income collectively. So those are two very good numbers to understand. What is your marginal tax bracket and how much did I really pay in taxes overall as a percentage of my income? And the reason I think it's very beneficial to go through your tax return is for tax planning purposes for the current year and understanding what is my tax bracket. If I'm in the 10 and 12% bracket, should I be taking advantage of things like tax gain harvesting, where you may actually create a gain in a taxable brokerage account and pay 0% because you effectively fit within the 10 and 12% bracket on all income. So that would be your earned income plus your long-term capital gains and dividends. If you're in a lower tax bracket, maybe it makes more sense to contribute to a Roth IRA or Roth 401k as opposed to a traditional IRA or traditional 401k. And what I like to do is create a one-page tax plan for the current year. I will walk through that real quickly here in a moment in the next section of this podcast. I hope this was informative, and I would encourage you to potentially replay this with your tax return in front of you if you didn't already. it's very beneficial to understand how all of these numbers work and flow through the tax return. And I like to think of it as understanding the rules of the game. Taxes can be a very large percentage of your income. And so it's very beneficial to understand how taxes work and how to minimize them legally, of course, and be able to take advantage of any tax rules that benefit you. So let's move on to the next section where we're going to talk about the one-page financial plan. And I'll just talk a little bit about what I do for myself. And it's more like a checklist for the year in preparation for managing my taxes to the most benefit I can for the current year. At the beginning of each year, I like to create what I call my one-page financial plan. And effectively what this is, it's a checklist of what I want to accomplish during the year from a financial perspective. After filing my tax return and reviewing everything, I like to revisit it and make sure that everything is the way I anticipate the year progressing. The things I will include on this one-page financial plan are, I put my filing status down here. I don't know why, I just do it. So for me, my filing status is single. I also put down the fact that I get my insurance through the marketplace, and I put down what my plan is. In my case, I've chosen an HSA eligible plan. I write what my premium is and any subsidy that I may be getting as a result of my estimated income. And then because I have an HSA plan, I contribute to a health savings account. And for me, I can put in up to $5,150 because I am over the age of 55 and can contribute an extra $1,000. So the standard is $4,150. And I can contribute an extra $1,000 for a total of $5,150. I am not employed, but if I were, I would also be writing down what my expected income is for the year. I would also be writing down what my contributions would be to my 401k if I had one. I would also note whether it was Roth or traditional, and what the match is if I was receiving a match. I would also write down what I would like to contribute to a traditional or Roth IRA. And in my case, I am actually withdrawing from my portfolio to live on because I do not have W-2 wage income. So in my one-page financial plan, I also write down where that income, effectively my paycheck to myself, is going to come from, what accounts, and in what frequency, and what amount I pay myself monthly, and then any other items that I want to accomplish throughout the year from a financial perspective. And for me, I'm able to target my income because depending on where those portfolio withdrawals come from, if they were to come from an IRA, that would be taxable income. If it's a traditional IRA, if it came from a Roth IRA, it would not be taxable income. So I can effectively control my income. I can choose what tax bracket to be in. And that's advantageous because if I am trying to get any subsidy for healthcare, targeting your income in order to receive a subsidy is beneficial. And then I may choose to do Roth conversions. And typically I will estimate what those Roth conversions will be throughout the year. I may do some at the beginning of the year, but as I get to the end of the year in October or November, I will look at what my actual income is to date and decide if I want to do some additional Roth conversions, for example. If I were over the age of 65, of Medicare age. I would also be planning any income as it relates to IRMA, the income related monthly adjustment amount, which is effectively an additional amount that you may need to pay towards Medicare if your income is above certain amounts. And those are cliffs. So if you're $1 over, you may move to the next bracket when it comes to IRMA. And so I would be watching that very carefully. I'm not of that age yet, but once I get there, I will start thinking about that. Actually, once I get to age 63, I will be planning for that because IRMA looks back 2 years at your income 2 years prior. So at age 63, I will start planning for that. But basically, I have this one-page financial plan, and I just check off anything that I've accomplished that I want to do. For instance, if I want to make health savings account contributions, I typically do them in January. But if I was doing it throughout the year, I would be notating what my contributions were up until that period. If I was employed and contributing to a 401k or a Roth or a traditional IRA, for example, I would be notating that as the year moved forward. For me, I'm withdrawing from my portfolio. It's a static monthly amount, so I don't need to notate that. I know based on that what month it is, how much I've received from there. I will target a certain income bracket, and if at the end of the year I decide to move to a different bracket, I can do that by doing additional Roth conversions, for example, and I usually make that decision in the fourth quarter. If I were in a low tax bracket, for example, let's say you're in the 10 or 12% bracket, I would be making a goal of making sure I fill that up with whether it's Roth conversions or potentially doing some tax gain harvesting where you're selling securities and actually creating a gain by being taxed at zero because you're in that lower bracket. That 0% tax bracket for long-term capital gains and qualified dividends, I would be looking at that. And so those are the things that I have on my financial planning checklist. And I think it's good to have that. I just keep it in a little folder. I mark things off as the year progresses. And after I do my taxes, I revisit it to make sure if there's anything that needs to be modified. And in the fourth quarter of the year, I revisit it to make sure that I've accomplished everything that I wanted to and make any adjustments that may be beneficial from a tax perspective. And the goal here is not to necessarily reduce your annual taxes or 1 year tax liability, but it's to think of your tax liability from the standpoint of your lifetime tax liability. And that's where things like Roth conversions come into play, because obviously if you do a Roth conversion, you're creating a taxable event. And some people may say, well, why would you do that when you could push that off to a later year? And the answer is, well, if you don't do those and you have a lot of money that gets accumulated in a traditional 401k or traditional IRA, the IRS is going to want its taxes at some point, and that's when required minimum distributions come into play. And for me, that will be at age 75. Previously, it was age 70 and a half, where you're required to take distributions from your pre-tax 401k, pre-tax IRA. That may push you in a higher tax bracket than if you were to have done conversions earlier in the tax planning window, post-employment, let's say, but pre-required minimum distribution age. You could elect to pay taxes earlier, but at a lower tax bracket by managing that tax consequence over time. So I like to think of things in terms of lifetime taxes as opposed to trying to minimize my current 1 year tax situation. And that's the difference between tax planning and just tax preparation. Hopefully that gives you some insight into how to read or understand your tax return and also some ideas on how to plan for the current year tax situation and future years as well. And now let's go to a listener question. Brad writes, my wife and I are both 55. Currently, we are on the ACA and submitted $40,000 of income for 2024 to pay zero in premiums, roughly a savings of $18,000 a year. Our annual spend is around $65,000, and we will take the additional $25,000 out of the money market, which is part of the $40,000 of ordinary income, which is interest income from the money market. And we have set aside enough to do this for 3 to 4 years. And he continues, my specific question is, how can we create more income from our portfolio to continue to maximize the premium ACA subsidies until we turn 65? His asset allocation percentages are 45% in Roth, 32% in pre-tax, and 23% in maybe taxable brokerage. All right, here's how I would think about this. There's two components. One is cash flow for your annual spend, and the other is income for ACA purposes. Your question is, how do we create more income? And some people may ask, why would you want to create more income? Well, there is an amount that you must make to avoid Medicaid. And I don't know what that is in each state, but there is an amount that you must make at least in order to be able to be eligible for ACA and subsidies as opposed to being on Medicaid. So there may be a reason that you actually want a certain amount of income so that you are eligible for the ACA. And based on that income, you may or may not receive subsidies. So in order to create income, you can do a couple of things. If you have a taxable brokerage account and you have gains in securities, you could sell those and create a gain, even if you repurchase those immediately because of the $40,000 of income married filing jointly. Those gains, provided that they aren't significant, will likely be taxable at 0%. So that's one way to create income. Another way to create income is to do a Roth IRA conversion, converting part of your pre-tax IRA to a Roth IRA. That amount would be considered income and counted in your total income. You would contact your custodian and say, I want to convert X dollars from my pre-tax traditional IRA into my Roth IRA. And then you'll get a 1099-R that says that is taxable income and that is added to your income. Now, for cash flow purposes, if you're trying to create cash flow, and I don't know if your question really revolves around how do I create more cash flow as opposed to more income. When I think of income, I think of taxable income. Cash flow is really just money in my pocket. And there's a couple ways to do that. One is if you had high cost basis shares in your brokerage account, you could potentially sell those at even potentially a loss. If you had some positions in a loss to create cash flow without creating income that is taxable. You potentially could sell high cost basis shares that have a minimal amount of capital gains. That would create cash flow. Obviously, if you had money in a savings account or a money market account, that's cash flow that you can pay yourself. That's what I do. That's where my paycheck comes from. It comes from my money market accounts. And if those get exhausted, you could then take distributions from your Roth IRA. Now, you mentioned you're 55, but you say you have enough to do this for 3 to 4 years, which will bring you to 58 or 59. Before age 59, you could take money out of your Roth IRA without penalty as long as the amount was less than your contributions. All of your contributions that you've made to a Roth IRA are able to be withdrawn without penalty and obviously without tax prior to age 59 and a half. If you have any conversions that are more than 5 years old, those could also be withdrawn without penalty and without tax. And since you say you have enough set aside for 3 to 4 years, it's very possible that your contributions and or any conversions that are over 5 years old will get you to that 59.5 mark, where then you could just take money out of your Roth IRA without penalty and without tax. And you could also take it out of your pre-tax IRAs. Obviously, you would be paying tax on that, but at least it's accessible without the penalty. So those are the levers that you can use to access cash flow and or create income if that's your objective. I hope that helps. I hope that answered your question. If not, and you want to send a follow-up, please feel free to do so. I'm happy to try to take a stab at it as best I can and think about it if I were in your situation. Before I close out the show, I want to mention two resources that I think are helpful in planning for taxes for the current year. The first is a tax calculator, which will help you estimate what your taxes will be for the current year. And it's called Dinkytown 1040 Tax Calculator. And I will link to that in the show notes. And then also my friend Andy Panko over at the Retirement Planning Education Podcast has a link for important tax numbers. It's kind of a cheat sheet for all of the current year's tax information. So I will link to that as well. So look for that in the show notes, and that should help you with planning for 2024 taxes. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous, and also your state of residence if you choose. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next week on the Mark's Money Mind Show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.